Well, we've been teasing around the issue of the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, and tonight we're finally going to get that dream revealed, and we're going to get into, Lord willing, the interpretation of that dream as Daniel gives it. So I want you to follow along. We're going to read the whole text, and then we're going to go back through it and look at it more carefully. And I'm following the outline that I distributed the very first week, and I have handed that outline to you for you to take if you choose to take notes. So remember in verse 30, Daniel had had told Nebuchadnezzar that the dream had been revealed to him and that it was because of the God in heaven that he had been given that information. Now, here's the dream. Here's the dream he had. And I'm going to contend, as I have already stated, that Nebuchadnezzar had not forgotten the dream. The dream was so impactful on Nebuchadnezzar that he did not want anyone to deceive him as to the meaning of the dream. If he were to reveal the dream, any interpretation could be given. And how would he know if that interpretation was accurate? No. Nebuchadnezzar, I think, concerned about misinformation, said the person who interprets this dream, and he expected it to be one of the wise men, one of these astrologers, or as the text calls them, Chaldeans. The one who interprets a dream also has to tell me what the dream was. By telling what the dream was, it would be verified to Nebuchadnezzar, this person is trustworthy. I can believe them. I can believe that they are truly seers, because they tell me what the dream is. And therefore, I can trust their interpretation. So here it is. That Daniel says, you saw, O king, and behold a great image. This image mighty and... I'm in chapter 2, verse 31. This image mighty and of exceeding brightness stood before you, and its appearance was frightening. The head of this image was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its middle and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. As you looked, a stone was cut out by no human hand, and it struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold all together were broken in pieces. It became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them could be found. But the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. We'll stop right there and we'll take a break, go back, and look at those verses in a little bit more detail. So the dream is revealed. Daniel has reported to King Nebuchadnezzar what the dream was. Nebuchadnezzar does not speak during this section. I think that's noteworthy. I think it's noteworthy. He doesn't affirm, he doesn't deny. He just listens. Now, if Nebuchadnezzar had forgotten the dream, wouldn't there be an aha moment? That's it. I don't think he forgot the dream. Now, I can't prove that. And I've noticed some other commentators suggest he had forgotten the dream. And that's why he was... How would you forget this? I don't think so. Especially when it had the emotional impact on Nebuchadnezzar that it had. Did you notice what it said? Its appearance was frightening. Daniel tells Nebuchadnezzar how Nebuchadnezzar felt seeing the image. That's remarkable. Now, we have no idea this image is. It's an image. It's a dream. It's a construct of his mind. So we don't know the size of this image. And it's best to think of this not as an idol, but as a statue. And this statue has a human form. It's possible, and I'm just throwing this out there. I'm not saying this is the case. I'm just saying perhaps it's this statue that Nebuchadnezzar has in mind when he orders a statue of himself to be constructed. If that's the case, and I'm not saying it is, then the statue would have been about 90 feet tall in the dream or in the vision. So you see there this human-like image is divided into four sections, and the sections are clearly delineated by differing metals. The first, the head, isolated, pure gold. The second section, the shoulders and upper abdomen or chest area, which includes the extremities, the arms, of silver. The abdomen and the upper thighs constitute the third segment of this human-like figure, and it's made of bronze. And the fourth section is the lower extremities, from the mid-thigh down, and its metal is what? Iron. Do you notice so far, do you notice anything about the metals in descending order? Say it again, Miss Erla.
I said value.
Their value. Yeah. They are diminishing in value as we go from top to bottom. Anything else? Huh? Actually, just the opposite is true. They're getting stronger. Iron is the strongest of the metals, but observation noted. There is a difference in strength. Anything else? Don't hurt yourself because I can't think of anything else. Just asking if you had something. Okay. Now, that is, I like what Leopold says in his commentary on this, and he's an early 20th century commentator, so he's real old school, but what he says about this, I think, is dead accurate. Daniel wastes no words. There is no embellishment here. He is telling exactly what the king saw. And even when he gets to the interpretive part, there is no embellishment. He simply tells the meaning, what these things represent, and therefore what they mean. So the second thing I want you to look at is in verses 34 and 35, that is this rock, this rock. We really didn't talk about the feet very much, because the feet are an extension of the legs. They're not unique. It's just that as you get down the legs to the feet, that iron is no longer singular, but it's mixed. Do you see that? It's mixed with clay. And for your information, the Aramaic word here for clay means it's baked clay. Pottery. It's pottery. A common element. Now, iron is the strongest element of those mentioned. And it's mixed now with clay. The clay is very fragile. The iron doesn't become fragile. But do they mix? No, they don't mix at all. So they're separated. Another way to put it would be they're divided. They're packed together, put together, but they're not joined. Just keep that in mind. I know that's important. And the reason I know is because I've read ahead. And I'm sure you have too. But then there's the other element of the dream. It's not that image, as striking as that image is. When you consider the other element of the dream, you discover it's actually more striking. And that is this rock. It says, as you look, a stone was cut out by no human hand. Cut out of what? Cut out of what? Well, it doesn't say. Doesn't say. Can we conclude that it was cut out of another rock? I think so. But that's about as far as we can conclude. So, it struck the image where? Where did it strike the image? Did it strike it on the legs? It struck it on the foundation. Oh, there's another thing. I didn't hear anybody say this. And I guess it's because maybe you didn't know it. Those elements we described are not only descending in value, they are also descending in weight. Gold is almost twice as heavy as the next heaviest item, which is silver. So it is descending from head to foot in weight. Well, that means it's what?
Top heavy.
Just worth noting. Top heavy, and the thing on which it's standing, its feet, which are part of the legs, is not even a singular substance. It's a mixed substance that has not, cannot join. You see that? And so that's where the rock strikes it. Don't be surprised. That's where the rock strikes it. But it's the effect of the rock striking those feet that is the most astounding thing. It not only, as expected, tumbles this statue, but it pulverizes it. It turns it into dust. The whole statue comes crumbling down. And that would be expected given what we know about the statue so far. But this pulverization, I don't know that we would get that. I don't know that we would expect that. How this stone gets to impact these feet in the dream, who knows? Daniel doesn't display that to us. Was it hurled? Was it hurled at the feet? Doesn't say. Was it cut out of a mountain and allowed to just roll out of a mountain and fall on the feet in the dream? We don't know. But it doesn't really matter how it came or with what force it came. It is the result. It's the outcome of its impact with these feet that is shocking. The thing is pulverized. It becomes dust. And it is compared to chaff at a summer threshing floor that the wind just blows away. The wind just blows it away. And so the idea is this monumental, fearful, fear-inspiring image is gone. But something remains. And what remains is that stone, that rock. And it becomes a great mountain, and it fills what? Fills the whole earth. You tell me you'd forget that image? You'd forget that dream? I don't think so. Any questions? Any comments? Observations you want to make? Or do you want to get to the interpretation? Let's interpret it. Verse 36. This was the dream. Now we. What? We? Who's we? Now we will tell the king its interpretation. Who do you think we is? Daniel and God? God through Daniel? Okay. Any other ideas? Now, I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm just asking. What are your immediate impressions? Does anybody think he might be talking about me and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego? We'll tell you. I mean, isn't that who prayed about this? Sure it is. However, in this context, it says nothing about them accompanying him. I tend to agree with Erla that what Daniel is doing here is Daniel is being careful to reiterate his own personal role in this. It wasn't just me. This is me and someone else. And the someone else is the one who he says revealed the dream to him. So we, God, the God of heaven, who revealed the dream to me, he's already said that to Nebuchadnezzar. Now he says, we will interpret it for you. We will tell you the king its tell the king its interpretation. God and I are going to do this. You, O king, the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, and the might, and the glory, and into whose hand he has given, wherever they dwell, the children of man, the beasts of the field, and the birds of the heavens, making you ruler over them all. You are the head of gold. Okay, I'm just pausing here for a moment of imagination. Even if I don't believe in Daniel's God, and I don't because I am not a Hebrew, I'm a Babylonian, and I believe that the God of creation is Marduk, and I don't really care who God is. What the important thing to me, Nebuchadnezzar, is I'm the head of gold. I'm the king of kings. Is that an odd term for an earthly king? And if this dream is being interpreted by God himself, along with Daniel, does it strike you as unusual at the least that the God of heaven in this dream is portraying Nebuchadnezzar, the head of gold, as the most valuable, the most significant, the most uniform, the most controlling, the most omnipotent king of all kings? Does that strike you unusually? It's meant to. It's meant to. I don't know, but I think we are supposed to be shocked. Frankly, I think Nebuchadnezzar probably should have been shocked if he actually thought there was a God. How in the world could he believe all these things that Daniel is interpreting the head of gold to mean? First of all, Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom, while he was the greatest king up to his point, his kingdom was not that big. It included what used to be Assyria. It included what used to be Egypt. It included the land of the country of Babylon, but very little other territory.
Why would God say that about a pagan king?
That's great. That's exactly what you have to ask. Doesn't it? But you know, I think it's interesting. That's not the only time the Bible describes Nebuchadnezzar as a king of kings. Ezekiel does the same thing. Now who made Nebuchadnezzar what he is? Who said that? God did.
It's also lowercase in all this.
King of kings, not king of kings, capital. Of course, in Aramaic, there's no capitalization to be indicative. We capitalize, by the way. You'll find the word God capitalized in the New Testament in Greek, for instance. There's no capitalization like that in what are called minuscule manuscripts. They're all lowercase. Everything is lowercase. Unless it begins a paragraph. And in that case, it would be capitalized. But nevertheless, at the very outset of this interpretation, Daniel indicates who made Nebuchadnezzar who he was, doesn't he? The God of heaven. Anything that is said of Nebuchadnezzar after that is always subordinate to the previous. Who made him what he is? And it was not only probably Nebuchadnezzar's estimation of himself that he was the greatest king of all kings. It was God's. And God intended that to be the case. God made Nebuchadnezzar the greatest king in history. The proof is right there. God said so. That's the interpretation of this vision. And as uncomfortable as it makes us feel, it is a stark reminder of the theme of this whole book, which is the sovereignty of God.
Folks,
and beyond. Actually, it's after he goes crazy, he does seem to acknowledge the sovereignty of God. Yeah, well, when he it's prophesied he's going to go crazy, and then he goes crazy, and he goes out into the wilderness like a wild animal, and then he comes to himself, and he goes, whoa, okay, and then he dies. The deathbed conversion, so to speak, but that's pretty dramatic, you know. I'm trying not to jump way ahead as we talk about this, but I don't think we realize how prone all human beings are to not forget, but basically disregard God's nature. Say, will you say this with me? Just. Be patient with me and allow me this. It's three words. And it's the deepest theology you will ever utter with your lips. God is God. Say that. God is God. When we have said that and settled it, when we have said that and settled it, events like this come into clear focus. Why was Nebuchadnezzar what he was? When he was, where he was? God. God. God is in control of this. Well, let's move ahead. Well, anyway, verse 39. Another kingdom. Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon, which, by the way, is indistinguishable from Nebuchadnezzar, is given two verses, 37 and 38. The kingdom that is going to replace Babylon is given one verse. Another kingdom inferior to you shall rise after you, and yet a third kingdom of bronze which shall rule over the earth. So two kingdoms in one verse. And then the rest of this is about a fourth kingdom. The rest of it is about a fourth kingdom. Now, Nebuchadnezzar's the greatest of all the kings of the earth, king of kings. God said so. And even though that may not include territorially, it evidently includes something in the sight of God that is significant. And I think that thing that is significant is that unilateral control that Nebuchadnezzar exercised. He took the kingdom, well, the kingdom was handed to him by his father, and yet he solidified that kingdom into an advancing kingdom. And as long as Nebuchadnezzar lived, the kingdom of Babylon succeeded. When Nebuchadnezzar died, the kingdom only lasted another 23 years, and it was gone. Now, the kingdom that replaced it was the silver kingdom. And it gets half a verse. And the bronze kingdom gets half a verse, same verse. And then the rest of it is this fourth kingdom. And that's where I want us to focus. Verse 40. And there shall be a fourth kingdom strong as iron, because iron breaks to pieces and shatters all things. And like iron that crushes, it shall break and crush all these. All these. All these. All these. What? Exactly. It is not that this fourth kingdom has to go and do battle against the third kingdom and the second kingdom and the first kingdom. It is that kingdom number one that is defeated by kingdom number two that is defeated by number three is wiped out by number four. And in doing so, as a kingdom, its power is greater than the other three. That does not mean its kingdom is greater. Its power is greater. Big distinction that we need to keep in mind. Verse 41, and as you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it shall be a divided kingdom. But some of the firmness of iron shall be in it, just as you saw iron mixed with the soft clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly iron and partly clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly brittle. Now let me ask you a question. This is a fourth kingdom. Remember, this fourth kingdom consists of the mid-thighs down. Do you remember what the portion that was legs was made up of? Iron. And now he's describing something that is made up of potter's clay and iron mixed together. But it's the feet. And specifically of the feet, he identifies the toes. Do you see that? Do you think that's important? I mean, why give the toes any space in this interpretation if it's not meaningful? He hadn't wasted language on anything else. I don't think he's wasting language here. I think he's making a point. Does anybody in this room have more than 10 toes? I'm serious. You can say so and we won't mock you. I went to high school with a girl. I'm trying to think if I know her on Facebook. I don't think I do. I don't think we're friends on Facebook. So it's very unlikely she's going to hear this, but it was a girl cute as a bug. I mean, she was a cutie. Sorry, Ruth, she was a cutie. Ruth's very cute, but Ruth doesn't have 12 toes. And that girl did. 6 on each foot. What? It's not unusual. It's not rare, I should say. Very unusual.
I bet you could really run.
Oh, gosh, Charlie. Charlie, what am I going to do with you? Now, those two end toes on her, were connected. They were webbed. All I'm saying is she was a swimmer. She wasn't a runner. Can't believe I said that. Anyway, that was my vision. I had that vision. and it hadn't left me. But I'm telling you, once it was exposed that she had 12 toes, that's all people could talk about. They never mentioned again how cute she was. It just kind of passed it all up. Now, the fact that Daniel gives time to the toes in this vision means it was significant. And we won't be able to leave this. The significance of it is going to be borne out in other visions. What is considered the normal number of toes? Right. 10 toes. The number 10 is not mentioned in this dream, but the toes are signified, and that's important. Don't forget it. Now, a balance thing? I can't interpret the interpretation yet.
Okay.
Daniel does, though, in another vision. I can see Brother Jim. He's getting ahead of me here. It's chapter 7, if you must. Chapter 7 is where the next vision that will give us information about this. Anyway, let's go on and look at the rest of this. Verse 42, and as the toes of the feet were partly iron and partly clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly brittle. As you saw the iron mixed with soft clay, so they will mix with one another in marriage. But they will not hold together, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of those kings... What? Wait. Hold on just a second. When we got to the head, there was a kingdom. And whose kingdom was it? Nebuchadnezzar. He was the king of that kingdom. He and that kingdom were inseparably identified as the same. second kingdom, the silver kingdom, gets half a verse and no mention of any kings. Same with the third kingdom. No mention of any kings, just of the kingdom. But of this fourth kingdom now, it says something unusual when talking about the toes. You see what it says? And in those days, the kings. Do you see that? The days of the fourth kingdom, those kings, the God of heaven, will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, nor shall the kingdom be left to another people. It shall break in pieces all these kingdoms and bring them to an end, and it shall stand forever, just as you saw that a stone was cut from a mountain. By the way, in his description of the stone, it says it was cut, but in his description of the dream, he doesn't say it was cut from a mountain. He only says that now. You see that? Okay. But it was cut by no human hand. What does that imply? Or supernatural, something non-human, supernatural. And that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold. A great God, and you see that's capitalized in English, a great God has made known to the king what shall be after this. After what? After what? After what? After him? Is that all that God revealed to Nebuchadnezzar, what would be after him? That'd be if that was the case, then the head would have shoulders and a chest and arms, but nothing else. No, he goes on. Nebuchadnezzar was shown his successive kingdom, a kingdom beyond that, and then a kingdom beyond that. But it says more than that. It says God has made known what shall be after this. After that stone crushes the final kingdom in this image. A great God has made known to the king what shall be after this. The dream is certain and its interpretation sure. Now, just so you know, that's it. Nebuchadnezzar exalts Daniel and gives him a raise, so to speak, a promotion, and he's elevated in the kingdom itself. As Daniel would be in the successive kingdom, the next kingdom. When Babylon declines and falls to the next kingdom, which history tells us is the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians, or the Medo-Persian Empire, which was actually it was the Persian Empire, but it was the form of governance that King Cyrus exercised that allowed conquered peoples recognition and authority. That's why we have Darius the Mede, who is also a king, called a king, during the time of King Cyrus. He was a local king. He was the king of what had been Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom. The Medo-Persian kingdom was larger than Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom, and this Darius the Mede was the king, or satrap, if you would, of that region. Now, I would love to go on, but it's 7 o'clock. And truthfully, I'm just thankful we got here tonight. Do you have any questions? Well, it would include all of Iraq as well. It would include northern Africa. It would include Assyria. It would include Eastern Europe, far Eastern Europe. Anyway. I'll just give you a bit of history. Probably would be helpful. It was around 146 BC that the Carthaginian Wars were won by Rome, and the inauguration, therefore, of the Roman Empire. That empire lasted until around 476 AD, when it was overthrown by the European hordes. I believe, and many conservative scholars believe, that empire, that Roman Empire, is represented in the legs of this statue. However, the legs of this statue seem to be bifurcated intentionally into mixed and unmixed iron. The legs are unmixed. They are iron, mixed with nothing. The feet are iron, mixed with something. Now, I'm telling you this because I want you to read ahead. I want you to read ahead through the next 3 chapters. Please read as far as you can without killing yourself. Try to read through chapter 5. Because you're going to find Daniel has his own vision. It's the first vision of Daniel. And this first vision of Daniel precisely parallels the vision of Nebuchadnezzar. But as the dream or the vision that Daniel has is interpreted, the kingdoms are identified, with the exception of the fourth kingdom. It is not identified. Amazingly, this book that was written in the 6th century B.C. predicts the coming and going of the Medo-Persian Empire, of the Greek Empire by name, both of these by name. Understand, Alexander the Great could have known and did know his future because the book of Daniel was published. It was known. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? I think it is. Anyway, as you can imagine, skeptical scholars, of whom modernity has many, do not believe in the supernatural. They don't believe in the miracles of the New Testament or Old. They don't believe in prophecy. They can't believe in prophecy. And therefore, they have to account for this. So, beginning with the a priori assumption that prophecy is not real, They conclude, based on that assumption, that Daniel must have been written after the fact. And they argue that it was written sometime during the Maccabean period of history. If you're interested in history, stick around. If you're not, you can go. But I just want to say this. Listen. It is fun. It is fun to watch skeptics twist themselves into knots they can't get out of. And the book of Daniel is the best knot maker. It is. I mean, if you believe this is inspired and therefore true, as I do, and yes, I have an a priori assumption that it's true, that leads me in certain directions. I'm going to conclude certain things that someone who has the a priori assumption it's not true will not come to. So let's just show our cards at the beginning and be honest about our assumptions. We all have them. Be honest about them. But the one who doesn't believe in the supernatural and therefore denies the authenticity that this book was written about or by a man in the 6th century B.C. must therefore assume that it is written by a Hebrew during the reign of Antiochus Epiphanes. And it was written to muster the faith of these Jewish rebellious heroes, the Maccabeans themselves. Well, the problem is, here's the problem. That's their construct. If Daniel was written in the 2nd century and interpreted the way modern scholarship wants to interpret it, then it's full of errors. And any faithful Jew in the 2nd century BC would have known this is nothing but folklore. Would they have been encouraged by a myth like the book of Daniel? Of course not. One of the biggest arguments against the historicity of this book is the naming of Darius the Mede. History has no account of a Darius the Mede, at least until the early 21st century. The latter part of the 20th century, a book was written by the name, titled Darius the Mede. And it was written by a scholar, conservative in his nature, who just wanted to look at all of the documents, all of the information that was out there. And he gathered it all from Qumran, from the Dead Sea Scrolls. He gathered it from Babylonian history. And you know what he discovered? Darius was not a name. It was a title. And the title meant king. King of the Medes. And guess what? There was a satrap king of the Medes who ruled under Cyrus the Great, the Persian king, who was the head satrap, or governor, if you would, of the region known as Babylon. Were there any other kings like that? Oh, wait. In the New Testament time, there was a guy named King Herod. Was King Herod the king of the world? Was he the king of the Roman Empire? No. He was a governor. Well, a head governor of Judea. I'm just saying, the arguments fall. They fall, folks. And I guess I've come to the place in my own studies that I have found it's best to just decide, do I believe God is God? If I believe God is God, then I, of necessity, must believe this is true. I must. And everything that I don't understand, everything that I can't reconcile, does not mean that it cannot be understood and does not mean that it cannot be reconciled, because we still don't know everything. But it's just amazing to me. The more we learn, the more we discover the Bible is true. All right, let's shut up and go home. I'm sorry. Thank you guys for being here and being patient with me. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this time together. I pray that you will increase our faith and trust in you as the sovereign God through this study of Daniel. We can understand a little bit more how Daniel could refuse to bow to Nebuchadnezzar. How Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego could refuse to worship at Darius's feet. Make our faith so grounded in your nature, in who you are, that we can't be bent, we can't be broken, and we will not bow over whoever is the king of this age. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.